Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties.
Montana just lost one of its best people, composer Phil Auberg. I had the chance to interview Phil about 3 years ago, and this is part of that interview.
Well, tell me about growing up on the High Line. It must have been a unique experience in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know, Montana is a unique experience anyway.
Exactly.
And, and Chester is really isolated. I mean, it's way in it. That's why you didn't come there, right?
I
mean,
I went to Chester.
Oh, you
just
did?
Weren't
okay.
There when I was
wasn't there. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you're a fan of Wallace Stegner's writing, but.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote a great book called Wolf Willow. I went to a reading when I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area in Black Oak Books in Berkeley.
Mm.
And he was reading then. It was right before he passed away. And I got to talk with him a little bit. And I said, so what, do you have a favorite book of yours? And I know that's a goofy question. He said, oh, Wolf Willow.
Oh, absolutely. Really?
Yeah, he said, that's my childhood, and that's a very unique part of the world. And in fact, when I was reading that, my brother and I read that. I think Steve gave it to me, and we both said, yeah, that could be Chester right there. That little town and the Cypress Hills, the Sweetgrass Hills, you know, the similarities are too big. Plus, it has a lot of sort of bootlegger trail Montana history in it. And I told him where I was from, and I gave him a copy of High Plains. It had that great picture of the kind of the big open area. And he said, Sweetgrass Hills, there's a great book waiting to be written about the Sweetgrass Hills.
Oh, cool.
And I said, I think so too. And that's, here's an album about the Sweetgrass Hills. So he took that and then he gave me one of his books.
Sweet.
Yeah. So growing up, I really loved my childhood. We had a lot of freedom. I think a lot more freedom than, I don't know if it's the same in Chester now, maybe not quite the same, but pretty much the same. My brother and I have talked about this all the time, how we were able to just, you know, roam, go outside of town, roam around the outskirts. And it wasn't wheat fields at that point. It was still a short grass prairie right up to town. There were a few fields, but they weren't close like they are now. So we had that experience, you know, and doing all the kids things that Montana kids do, you know, you have a rifle and you go out and you kill things, and which I don't do very much of anymore. But there was a lot of freedom. And the other great thing about growing up in a little town is if you have talent in anything, people are going to support you. And plus, you get a chance to do all these things that you would not get to do if you grew up in a big town. I was on the basketball team.
Right.
I'm not a big guy. I'm not a tall guy. I was a forward on the basketball team. We took second state in Class B. And, you know, get to do all that sort of stuff, get to play baseball. You know, I played Little League, Babe Ruth, a year of American Legion. It was, you just don't get those experiences. And I think that also helped me get support from the town. I mean, the town really was phenomenal in supporting what I did from a real early age, from first time I gave a recital. And when I played basketball, I was taking the train to Spokane to study with Margaret Ott, just the greatest teacher in the world. And I knew I would have to miss a day. So there were two basketball practices a month. And normally a coach would say, no, you're not on the team.
Right.
But my school gave me the chance to make up the work. My coach played me, you know. Don Van Dessel, great guy. So it was terrific doing that. And in fact, you know, if I could turn this camera around, there's a upright piano here that was in the hall called the RNA Hall, where the Rotary Club used to have their meetings. And I think from seventh or eighth grade, I would go over there whenever they had their meeting. I don't know, once a month maybe. And I'd play Star Spangled Banner and the Montana State song, and then a tune, and then I'd eat dinner with them, you know, so I was kind of an honorary Rotary Club member. So when we actually bought the old RNA Hall to, we're gonna do some stuff with it, and it's owned by a woman who has a dance troupe now, and that old piano was in there, and I said, whose piano is that? From the folks that we bought it from, and they said, oh, that's yours, you can have that. So this piano that I played, and it's beautiful upright
piano.
It's in such great. I'm going to make a record with it because it's just kind of a perfect, perfect blues piano, I would say.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to hear you describe that. How different it is in a small town because, you know, Billings. I graduated here, and basically, if you have to choose one thing, if you're in the music program, you're in the music program, so you don't get a chance to try out for the basketball team. I mean, there's just too much conflicts with the rehearsals and practice and all that. So I think that is unique to small towns.
Yep. I think it's a little different. Coaches are, they're under a lot more pressure now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not quite as willing to
be flexible.
Yes.
So how did you hook up with that teacher in Spokane?
Well, you know, the music festivals were a little bit different when I was growing up. I think there were, I'm not quite sure how it is now, but at one point, you know, there was just one state festival, and that was in Missoula.
Mm.
So you would have these, I guess they call them district festivals, where you would play, you'd take turns, schools would take turns. I think there was even one in Chester because we had a pretty big auditorium. But you go there, and it was so great to see all these kids who were interested in the same things that you were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because in a little town, I mean, they understand that I play and they understand that I practiced a lot and that I was good and everything. But knowing the love of it is a whole different deal. I mean,
right.
The fact that I played rock and roll was another really good thing for me. But so we would go to these district festivals, and then you would get a rating. And if you got a one, you get to go to Missoula to state.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was a sophomore, I think, I went to state, and I played twice for this adjudicator, Margaret Saunders Ott.
Oh, okay.
And the thing that I noticed was, you know, there were like four different piano adjudicators and they all had different rooms. Margaret's room, Margie May's room, was packed. You couldn't get in there.
Oh, really?
And there were 30 teachers waiting outside the door to hear what she had to say.
Oh, wow.
Oh, this is interesting. And
yeah.
Really, she had maybe 10, 15 minutes with each student, with each person who was playing. She gave them a lesson that would last the rest of their lives.
Wow.
And at that point, too, I was going back and forth during the summer. My uncle and aunt lived in Bozeman. I was going there during the summer to take lessons in fish and do stuff. And one of the teachers there, Henry Campbell, who's still a piano teacher there, he was on the faculty at the point, said, you know, you're good, but if you want to get better, you got to find a good teacher. And I thought, well, there's no north-south travel in Montana. There just wasn't at that point, and there was no flying. I wasn't going to be able to afford flying around, but there was the train. And when my mom heard Margaret Ott, and you know, everybody was just awed by her. And she said, "Would you like to study with her?" And I said, "Well, of course, but she's in Spokane."
Yeah.
She said, "Well, we can figure something out."
Really?
We didn't have a lot of money, so we went down to Spokane, and Margie May gave me a 2.5-hour lesson. She taught me all kinds of stuff in that lesson. And then at the end, she handed me a copy of Beethoven's Concerto No. 1. And she said, okay, in May, this is the competition piece for the Spokane Junior Symphony, and the winner gets to play at the symphony. She said, come back in 2 weeks and have this memorized. And I said, okay, this is my test.
Yeah.
And I did.
Wow.
I did, and I came back and started taking lessons with her. And then after a while, I was staying with friends of my family's in Spokane. Mom had gone to Holy Names College for 1 year. That's all they could afford. And stayed with her friends that were there. And then Margie May and her family invited me to stay with them. So at that point then, the train no longer stopped in Chester. It stopped in Shelby. So my mother would get, you know, 3 a.m. or something, drive me to Shelby.
Jeez.
I get on the train, I get there, I would take a lesson, then I'd play ping pong with her boys or mess around or do something and practice at their little piano in the basement. Then I'd have another lesson at night. And
oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. And then Monday I'd have another one, and then I'd stay until midnight, I guess, was the time the train was. And Monday night was when the Spokane Symphony played. And at that point, the Symphony Hall was, I don't know, 2 blocks from the train station. So I'd take my little suitcase and my friends and who were Margie students, who just, they became lifelong friends. Mm. We would sit up in what we called heaven, which was the top row, was the chief seat, you know. And then they'd all walk me to the train station.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was.
What an amazing experience for
us. It was idyllic. It was idyllic.
So that must have had something to do with you getting your, being able to go to Harvard then.
Yeah, totally. Margie May again. I mean,
yeah.
When I was a junior, she said, "Well, honey, what did you call everybody, honey? Well, honey, what would you, what do you think you want to do for college?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, MSU, University of Montana." She said, "I think you should go to Harvard." I think I also said Juilliard, and she had gone. She was the first, I believe, she was the first woman to get a master's degree from Juilliard.
Wow!
And she said, "Oh, you don't want to go to Juilliard?" And I said, "Well, why is that?" And she said, "Well, those kids practice 10 hours a day, and they don't know anything." Which I've said to some of my Juilliard friends, and they're very offended by that. She said, "You should go to Harvard." I said, "Why?" I knew nothing about Harvard other than that was this big school, you know, this big deal. And she said, "Well, the real reason to go to school is so that you enrich your life and that you're able to know something about a lot of different things in depth and that you spend a lot of time with really good people." And I said, "Sounds right."
So she was more than a teacher. She was a She was a philosopher.
Yeah, she is one of those people that I always say to people, I wish everybody that I know could have spent 45 minutes with her, because the world would be a better place. No doubt about it. She was amazing.
Well, it's interesting that you have such a varied background, because I mean, it still comes through in the music you write now. You cover so many different genres in a single piece, even. Which is one of the things I love about it. So, yeah.
Thank you. I think this is our job, you know, to find out who we are. Imitation is part of that learning. You know, you go through that when you're younger. You might go through it for a longer period of time, but eventually, if you're lucky, you kind of figure out what your deal is, you know.
Right.
Figure out who you are. I mean, it might not happen until you're 80. Who knows? That's fine. It's your life. It might happen when you're 15. But I've seen so many people have point A to point B. They've got it all plotted out. And then they hit point D where they're supposed to have something. They say, you know, they say, like Talking Heads said, "Is this my beautiful house? Is this my beautiful wife? Oh my God, what have I done?" You know?
Is this all there is?
Yeah. So, I think there was there are a lot of stories that I've told, and one of them involved making that choice about really deciding to be who I was. And maybe it was more difficult because I had a lot of options. I had a lot of opportunities, and they would have all involved narrowing the scope of what I do, which a lot of people are comfortable with, but I realized I was not. That's just me, you know. A lot of people are good at focusing, like I had a teacher who said, maybe you'll be a Haydn specialist. And it was like, what in the world does that even mean? What to a life, you know, what is that? But there are people who can fit that. I just I'm not one of them.
Yeah. Well, it's great that you figured out a way to use that versatility. So in that same vein, you somehow ended up in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and that became a studio musician. How did that all come about?
Yeah, well, my wife at the time didn't finish her degree at the University of Denver, or DU, I guess it was, and she decided she wanted to go to Mills College in Oakland. So we packed up and went to California, and I thought, California, rock and roll.
That's
you know, not knowing the difference between the Bay Area or Los Angeles, I just, and it turned out the Bay Area was kind of perfect for me. She got her degree at Mills College, and I started playing with blues bands, and then I chose wisely. It was not in terms of making money, but Perry and the Pumpers was a band that was playing in North Beach, and a lot of blues clubs in those days. I think it's kind of coming back a little bit. And he was making no money at all, but it was absolutely real. It was like graduate school in blues and R&B. And I just jumped in there, and we had a blast playing. And Melvin Bishop would come back. The Bay Area was a really interesting place in those days because it was like band central. I mean, Santana, Elvin, Journey, all these bands were there, and they all came back, and they'd play around in the area. They'd come and jam in the clubs, and Elvin would always come and sit in with us. And in fact, he stole three people from Perry's band to join his band, including
you.
You know, I'm a humble guy, so when I saw Elvin play, I said, "Well, that's a really good band. They'd be twice as good if I was in it."
And you were right.
I was right. And Elvin called me up one day, and I knew he was going to fire his other keyboard player because they just were spitting fire at each other on stage. And he said, "Hey, Phil, do you want to go down to Macon and make a record?" And I said, "Yep." And that was
nice. Fooled Around and Fell in Love part of the first one you were on, or?
No, Fooled Around was probably the third album, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
You must have toured with them quite a bit then over the years.
First year we were on the road 310 days. So
oh, wow.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was nuts.
Yeah.
Literally.
And then when they had that hit, did you get to do some pretty big venues for the...
Well, we were already playing that stuff.
Oh, you were.
By the time I played on the hit, I had quit the band.
But
we had toured with that song, and it was a pretty integral part for that album. And so he asked me if I would record with him and that, and then I think three others that following that one I recorded with him. But yeah, we were playing. We played it. Huge venues, and we played with everybody. We opened for Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. And
oh, did you really?
Stewart and Bachman Turner, Overdrive. And, I mean, everything. It was crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, did you get to know those guys?
The guys in the other bands?
Yeah.
Some of them. Yep.
Mm-hmm. That just must have been a blast.
Yeah, it was really high times for sure. It was interesting. And I'm not, I got this, I think my brother and I both have this deal where I don't think it's arrogance, but it's kind of a Montana deal where you go into situations, you're not really fully aware of the import of all those situations or, you know what I'm saying? I called it, I think I made this up. It's a term that means, not expecting anything. Anastrophic anticipation. I don't think there is such a thing, but I made it up, I think.
I can't find
it anywhere. But anyway, so I would go into these situations and I think a lot of people looked on me as arrogant, but the fact is I had this ability to like close everything off that I knew about a situation. And I think Steve's the same way as an archaeologist.
Is that what he does?
Yeah. He learns everything he can about something, then he goes into it and he pretends like he doesn't know anything so that he sees all kinds of stuff that other people don't. I'm not saying I just see all things that other people don't, but I'm saying that it enabled me to go to a lot of places, like just throw myself into the deep end.
Sure. So did you finally end up just doing mostly studio work later on, or
were you always? At one point, after Elvin, I was trying to stay home more because I was starting to have kids. But that didn't last long because Peter Gabriel asked me to go out with him.
Well, you got to say yes to that.
I said yes to that, and that was great. Yeah. And then people kept asking me to tour with them. So I did that, you know, Maria Muldaur, John Hiatt, Roy Rogers, I had always played with, the slide guitar player. And then Tom Johnston, who wrote most of the hits for the Doobie Brothers, Long Trip.
Oh, yeah.
Listen to the music. So I toured with him for a long time. In fact, just a little while ago, when Bill Payne, who was keyboard player with Little Feet and then was playing with the Doobies for, I don't know, toured with them for 4 or 5 years or something, maybe longer, decided he wanted to go back and concentrate on Little Feet, Tom Johnston called me up and says, "Hey, you still touring?" And I said, "Yeah, this was a couple of years ago." Well, a year and a half ago. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I would really love if you came and joined the Doobies and toured with us." And I said,
"Wow.
Yeah, sounds great." You know, it would have been really fun. But there were, you know, there's three main guys in the Doobies, and then Michael McDonald was also playing keyboards, and Michael decided he wanted to do all the keyboards.
Ah.
I'm certainly not going to say he can't do all the keyboards.
Right. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. But that would have been fun.
For sure.
You know, and I was talking with Tom. It was interesting. I said, "Okay, so he's pretty much my age." I said, "Here's a weird thing with me. I think I'm playing better than I ever did." He said, "Yeah, me too."
Oh, really?
I mean, we were in our 70s. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I heard the Doobies, and it was, yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think they're a better band than they ever were.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Well, it's crazy. Can't say that about a lot of 70, 80-year-old guys who are touring with rock and roll bands now, but some of them do, definitely. Mm. When you think about music, it's just, you know, two of my favorite concerts were Rubinstein, Artur Rubinstein, who was 83 when I heard him.
Wow. I think.
Maybe not that, 80 anyway. And Rostropovich, who's a great cellist. Both of them were, he was probably in his 70s.
Mm.
And I just, you know, they're no longer matinee idols or anything, but man, the wealth of knowledge and the ability to communicate the essence of what a piece is was just so strong with them. There's a lot of great pianists around, a lot of great young musicians, and to me, it's usually a lot of flash and speed and stuff, and that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hope that they grow up so that they could play better, you know?
Right.
You know, I had good training. Margaret Ott taught me all these things about relaxation. I've been able to play hours and hours, and that doesn't happen to everybody. You know, a lot of people have muscle problems, carpal tunnel, and stuff like that.
That's amazing. Yeah. So even she was innovative even in that respect. That's pretty incredible for that time.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, she was brilliant.
Huh.
Yeah. I was lucky.
So what made you decide to move back to Montana eventually?
You know, I always wanted to move back to Montana.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw myself living somewhere else for the rest of my life.
Me too.
And that's why you came back. Yep. I think that's why a lot of people come back.
Mm-hmm.
That's why a lot of people don't leave too. My brother just, he just can't face it. You know, the idea of not being here. And it's a love for the place that I felt even when I was in Cambridge, which was about as far away from Montana and my cultural life as I could get, you know. I always kind of felt myself leaning towards the West, you know. And then California, when I got to California, I said, I'll give myself 5 years. And I was there for 24. And then finally we had the chance to come back here and came back to Chester. It was a great place. My wife Patty and I had a little boy in the Bay Area, Jake, and we decided Chester would be a great place for him to grow up, and it was. It was. And then we came out here when he was ready to spread his wings and, you know, have bigger a bigger venue, I think.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about what it is about Montana, and you know, I'm gonna harken back to when I interviewed you for the book. One of the things that I loved that you said was we were talking about basically what some of the myths that are not really true, and you talked about the whole independent spirit that people refer to all the time, and you said that it's really not true that people here are independent because we need to rely on each other so much. So it's more that we're interdependent, and I always loved that.
Yeah, I forget who said that, but somebody was talking about the myth of the Old West and the the rugged individualist.
You know? Right, exactly.
And this guy said, well, the only rugged individualists are hanging at the end of a rope. And I think that carries over. And I think, you know, it's kind of basic, you might call it Midwestern values, but it's to me, that's what a Montana value is. And one of the Montana values is, if somebody's broken down by the side of the road, you stop and help them. Doesn't matter whether you're wearing your three-piece suit for a wedding or whatever, you stop and help them. That's just what you do, because who knows how long they're going to be out there? Who knows what kind of trouble they're in? And they would do the same thing for you. So those are the kind of things. You know, I just lost a dear friend of mine, and was pallbearer at his funeral, and I was talking about him a little bit, and that's one of the things that I mentioned about him. I'm not a military person, but I said, I find that I choose my good friends by doing this mental imagining of them being in a foxhole in World War II with me. Now, would they would they have my back? I know a lot of politicians who would not have my back, and they pretend to be military. I didn't want to get into that, but here I am. Yeah, I think that is a prime thing. And I think, unfortunately, we're up against a national culture that's weird. And and I'm talking about things like the Yellowstone series. And, you know, I've had friends who've been in the cast on that and everything. And I just, and some people say, well, it's just a soap opera. And I, you know, that's like saying a Western is just a movie. I think the Westerns and the dime novels, you know, that were Ned Buntline and all that stuff back in the history of Montana, where they would make up stuff about these rugged guys and their lives and how that was something to admire. And, you know, the cowboy is one thing, but cowboys do a lot more than shoot people and bury them in a ravine. You know, what is that all about? And people actually come out here thinking that's what Montana is. It's a lawless place. It's not. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's kind of what we got. You know, you got the big hat deal going on. You got the big belt buckle deal going on. And that has its place. And there are people who deserve to have that. And there are other people who don't.
Right. Well, Phil, thank you so much for, first of all, thanks for letting me use your music for the podcast.
You're welcome.
It's been just a great compliment to the format, I think. And but also thanks for all you've contributed to the culture of Montana. I think you're a vital part of our landscape. So bravo to you, and keep it up.
We all do what we can.
Yeah.
So for those of you who are listening, I was talking with Phil Auberg about 3 years ago. We just lost Phil last week. He was a Montana treasure. Thanks for listening to this episode of 56 Counties.